Are we doing this one or not?
Yes.
Yeah, fine.
Yes.
You sent it.
I know. It is really funny. I just don't know if it's good faith or not. That's all.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Human Reaction. I am Joe Sheehan, this is David Rand, Kyle Mack, and Bennett on the buttons. We're so glad to have you join us. If you're new here, please smash the like button. Like, follow, subscribe anywhere you are watching or listening to this show. Leave us a review if you have the time to. And if you would like to become a member and get access to our exclusive members-only content, go to humanreactionpod.com to find out how.
And also, join our Discord, where you can chat with us about the news, and also you can see what I'm going to say is a very dank meme about our current topic today.
The dankest of memes.
It's one of the dankest of memes that we've had in a while, where we have Ben Shapiro here in that scene from Shrek with Lord Farquaad saying, "Some Christians may die."
No, do it in the voice.
How's it? Some Christian, or, oh wait, are you some asking Christians, me for a Ben Shapiro? Oh, a Ben Shapiro die. Voice. Sorry, I was going for a Lord Farquaad voice. Some Christians may die, but that's a sacrifice we're willing to make. is that a Ben Shapiro?
That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
Give it a 6.5 out of 10.
Yeah, yeah.
Room for improvement.
Yeah, above I was prepared in my mind mentally for Lord Farquaad. So
that's fair. That's fair. Join the Discord, David. What are we talking about today?
Somewhere in hell, deep in the deep recesses of hell, Charles Krauthammer is fully erect this week. Radical Islamists have taken over Syria, overthrowing a secular dictator, and we don't know what's going to happen. You know, as of the making of this podcast,
my bet is slavery.
If Libya holds, probably slavery.
I remember the good old days when you could go on YouTube and see some good open air slave market footage in Libya.
Wait, that's still in Libya right now. But yeah,
but YouTube's cleaned it up a little bit. Yes.
Get that algorithm.
David, someone's got to proofread your jokes before you tell them.
Oh, come on, it's
just
too good.
That one was just over the line. That man was handicapped. You can't do that.
He is the principal architect.
So is Dave. He's colorblind.
Foreign policy. Now, principal architect might be too strong, but at least lead rhetorician for American foreign policy throughout the Bush years. Like, he can't you got to weigh him heavily.
That's fair.
So, like, what kind of handicap is he?
He was in a wheelchair.
So can he get fully erect?
Anyways, so what's happening in Syria, guys?
The Syrian civil war appears to be over as of this week. Assad has fled the country. A new government is being formed out of the coalition of rebel forces that have been fighting there since 2013, 2011, kind of in that time period. That's the end of the story. It went from, I mean, even in the time frame, and this happened very quickly, it went from last week being like, oh, we should cover that. There's a lot of news going on about a new offensive in Syria. We should probably take a look at it, see if it's worth covering next week, to this is the story of this week.
To this, like, is a new country.
Yeah. That country's gone. New country's forming.
So you mentioned
Syrian civil war. I know we're going to get into history, but I think a lot of people are probably not going to be super well aware of the fact that there was one, because maybe Syria's not on a lot of people's map, literally or figuratively. So can we kind of lay out the backstory here of, like, kind of what precipitated this event?
Yeah, so you remember the Arab Spring?
Yeah,
yeah. Egypt, so Tunisia. 2011, there was a uprising, something probably originally organic, leveraging social media networks heavily into a series of protest movements to literal overthrowing of governments across the northern rim of Africa into the Middle East.
And this was like late 20-teens, is that right?
No, this was 2011.
No. Oh, yeah, wow. This was a lot longer ago than that.
You were way off.
Damn, I'm so old now. Because I remember following this on Twitter kind of as it was happening.
Mm-hmm. This is the end of the Obama first term in office.
Okay.
And it's kind of seen as, you know, there's a lot of interpretations at the time. Some of it was, oh, this is a result of climate change. I remember that narrative. To this is a result of the hope and change that Obama would bring to the world, that you'd have all these democratic, you know, inspired young people would stand up and across all these countries.
The Arabs are getting really spicy with the heat going up.
Well, it is already very hot over there.
Well, it had to do with food production. But yeah. Arab Spring started with a guy in Tunisia who got shaken down by the local police. He went to the town square. Said what he was about, that the regime was corrupt and terrible, and lit himself on fire, self-immolated. And it changed the trajectory of the Middle East at that time. It's really an incredible, powerful, insane story. Now, our typical understanding of that prior to within the last like 3 years or so was this was an organic bottom-up thing that happened because of that. And that's probably true at least for the first year, couple months, something like that. But what we do know now from the Twitter files and from Mike Benz's work and Michael Schellenberger's work is that eventually the State Department changed what they called Diplomacy 2.0, where they said, wow, we have the capability of projecting soft power using social media into these countries, so we can use that offensively and defensively. So we can work with Twitter to keep Twitter working in Egypt, where we did want to overthrow Mubarak and implement someone who was easier to work with. And this is, and keep in mind where Egypt's located, right between them and the Sinai Peninsula and Israel, right there. And we could use it defensively, like in countries where we don't want any change, we can prohibit that change, we can stifle that change. Those were really the first tools built that we now understand as the censorship industrial complex, both from the like USAID and capability building end of it to like when we're thinking like think tanks and centers and media contacts to the algorithmic and the strategic levels of what we now experience as the censorship industrial complex. That started with the Arab Spring that then changed over circa 2016 in that time frame with Donald Trump and Brexit.
So when did Syria come into the picture? Because we've talked about Egypt and Tunisia being the origin of the Arab Spring in 2011. Mm-hmm. Syria comes into the picture in 2016. What happened?
Yeah, so not in 2016. Syria comes into the picture in 2013 with what is called Operation Timber Sycamore, which is a covert operation where Obama, and we only know that this, we know about this because of WikiLeaks and Hirsch and people like that, where the Operation Timber Sycamore was Obama and Hillary Clinton, because according to people from the Obama administration around him, Obama didn't really want to go into Syria. Do much in Syria, but Hillary Clinton really wanted to.
Obama had a red line, if you remember the red line.
Mm. Well, that came later, but yeah. But it started as a program to use the covert operations to do a color revolution in Syria and overthrow Assad.
Okay, since we've gotten to Assad, who is Assad? What's his story?
Yeah, so Bashar Assad.
Bashar al-Assad. Right?
Al-Assad, yeah. His regime was started with a coup in 1970, establishing a Arab nationalist state. This is a secularist, what would be called across the Middle East is Baathist. So think of the same party as Saddam Hussein was. He's not a religious fundamentalist. He's not like a Shiite radical like the people who run Iran. He's not a Sunni radical like the folks who run Saudi Arabia. These guys are secular dictators who operate, in this case, in kind of like a monarchical tradition. He inherited basically the throne in 2000 and has been in charge ever since.
Would you call him like kind of a political moderate in that region? Does that track?
That's a way to think about it. I mean, it depends on your standards for moderation, right? Sure. So obviously what we're not looking at here are first world countries or Western countries with Western norms and first world country norms. Both Saddam Hussein and Bashar al-Assad had like the equivalence of the church of the Anglican church in England, right? Where they did have religious stuff that was built into the state, but it was de-emphasized and more secularized overall. And then you did have a lack of civil liberties and free speech and all that kind of stuff that's typical across the region and across most places on the earth, right? I mean, keep in mind, the UK is imprisoning people for memes at the same time that we're criticizing Bashar al-Assad for a lack of freedom of expression.
Yeah, like his enemies would call him essentially a fascist or a Nazi, but in reality, he's pretty moderate in comparison to all of the new leadership that has popped up in the region.
Yeah.
So that's also the case of a lot of these dictatorships, quote unquote, that we toppled across the region. Is a lot of them were kind of secular and had various minority rights in the countries. Like minorities were doing okay, and then new people come in, and then there's slavery, right?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, and that was typical of Syria. Syria has a lot of diversity. They have large Christian populations, Alawite populations, and other.
I think it's like 12 million or something. Yeah. Isn't it like 12 million Christians?
Yeah, they have a lot, and they've coexisted. They've always had their own little militias in a very decentralized civil society structure of the use of force and violence outside the state. So therefore, their states are a little bit weaker overall anyways. But these are very... it's a very different state than what you would see in like the UAE or Saudi Arabia, where it's very monolithic, right? Everyone's the same religion there. So they have it, they kind of run the rules that way.
So Assad came to power in a coup in the 70s.
And his father did.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Kind of got it handed to him.
I see. So he kind of inherited the throne, and it's one of those like monarchical family kind of dynamics with the Assad regime, right?
Correct.
So he came to power in 2000, and then what happened after that?
So there was the Obama's red line, which is a gas attack. He basically says, well, Assad has these chemical weapons, and we don't want him to use them. And then there was the accusation of a chemical attack by the Assad regime on his own people. And then it was like, well, now I have the mandate. Well, what happened in 2013 is, keep in mind, Obama comes in 2012.
2008.
Yeah, so 2008 as a peace candidate. By 2011, that had been strained but not tested. In 2013 is really when the test happens, right?
So there's this claim by the West, right, that Assad had used chemical weapons against his own people. Mm-hmm. Was that substantiated?
Our second favorite reporter, Seymour Hersh, did a media run at that point, basically saying it's bullshit. We have a short video here we can react to. This is him talking about al-Nusra, which we will get into. But keep in mind, when you think of al-Nusra here, this is functionally ISIS, al-Qaeda in Syria at the time. It's a rebel group, and we'll dive into the background of al-Nusra in a little bit.
Okay.
Chemicals to al-Nusra, which ISIS wasn't there then. Al-Nusra was the cutting edge. And so there was...
Linked to al-Qaeda.
Tremendous, yes. Well, absolutely linked to al-Qaeda. We always link everything to al-Qaeda because there was a law passed in 2002 after the invasion that said anytime al-Qaeda is involved, the president can do what he wants without Congress. So we always call everything al-Qaeda. I mean, everything around in Libya was al-Qaeda, and throughout Africa. We use al-Qaeda because that gives you the cover of the law. Congress passed that stupid act, giving Bush the right to intervene anywhere without going congressional authorization. It's an amazing piece of legislation. Talk about dumb. Anyway, the point is, this report troubled everybody. There was a study done about what can we do about it. How many people, American soldiers, we didn't want al-Nusra to have nerve agents. Suddenly comes this attack, and we get a sample from the Russians, and it's taken to Sir Peter Wall, who is the director general, the head of the British military. The sample is taken to his people.
Porton Down, yeah.
They go take it to Porton Down, where they conclude, we know what the Syria has. Syria's been a signatory to the Geneva Convention on Chemical Weapons. We know what Syria has. We know what it looks like. And what was used in that place was not the same as in the Syrian military. This is told to Obama two times by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs before. The reason he didn't bomb, remember the red line, when the attack took place. So when the attack took place at allegedly 1,400, it was one-tenth as many, it doesn't matter. When the attack took place and people were killed and the world said Bashar Assad did it, my government said that, the government knew. They knew from this very important intelligence report that caused a huge study to be done inside about what to do about it. It would take 60,000 troops to get into the war. We were thinking of maybe sending troops on the side of Bashar, really, to get rid of this stuff. We didn't want these guys to have it. And of course, that was too many troops and it didn't happen. But they knew there were two suspects that knew al-Nusra had the stuff and Syria had the stuff.
Now there are two of them.
Forget about having it analyzed. They knew right away, and they only talked about one. And so I wrote an article saying, wow, let's hold on, folks. And what I also learned, because I was writing months later, is that the material that was taken by Russian intelligence.
Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, they tested it, and it's not the kind of gas, nerve agent, that Assad would have had access to. The reason why we know that, and just to rewind that just so make it clear to everybody, is because they were signatories to a treaty that said that they're going to have their stuff tested regularly by international bodies so that there's a signature to that nerve gas.
Oh man. So they have nerve gas.
Yes.
But this compound was not the same one.
Yes.
But he said there were two entities that had biological or chemical agents. The other one was al-Nusra,
mm-hmm.
And so it was, it sort of, it seems in this case, he's pointing to the fact that it was al-Nusra that used the weapon, yeah, not the Assad regime.
Yeah, and if I understand his argument from, that's not included there, is that they believe they got it from Turkey.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, small aside, like, are chemical weapons, like, legal in the world? Are those allowed?
No, you're not supposed to deploy them. Although, it depends on how broadly you categorize.
You're not supposed to deploy them, but you can have them?
You can have them as a deterrent.
I always remember
if I understand the international law right, and it's more like, it's kind of like nuclear weapons where you're not supposed to proliferate them, but
you can have them just in case.
These are states. These are liars by definition. Everyone knows that.
Right? Sure. Yeah.
I always remember back during the original red line because our gas attack, because this also happened under the Trump administration too. There was also another gas attack that happened just like as Assad was winning the civil war. All of a sudden he gassed his own people, right? It just tends to be a trend with Assad, is he makes very poor military decisions with gas attacks as he's about to win civil wars. But there was a CNN correspondent on the ground in Syria, I remember, and she like picked up a cloth and she goes, "Yep, that smells like gas." Like on live TV. I was just looking for the video, but I can't find it. And then I remembered a bunch of internet sleuths did some digging, and she's like the granddaughter of one of Assad's political opponents working as a CNN correspondent on the ground in Syria.
I remember
it was
that.
Like a whole thing.
Yeah.
But
can we rewind just a little bit?
I want to finish your question real quick.
Sure.
So what I was making mention of is Obama was a peace candidate. He really was tested by this in his red line, where a lot of the people from the left who supported him based upon him being different from Bush stood up and said, "No, we're not invading Syria," right? Mm-hmm. On either side of this. We're not doing it on the Assad side or on the opposite side. And then it was additionally the confusion about whether or not it was a real gas attack by Assad and how poorly that op was pulled off if it was a false flag.
Right. So that is, thank you for clarifying that, because I was going to ask, can we really clearly define the red line? But that was it. It was basically, yeah, his supporter said, we're not going to support you if you do this. We don't want to do this.
The red line was Obama saying, if they use nerve agents, we have to do something.
Oh,
the international,
I see,
community has to do something. We're going to NATO or the UN or whatever.
I see. Okay.
And that was left somewhat vague about what he'd do, but it was kind of heavily implied it would mean direct military intervention.
And then Obama didn't do anything, mm-hmm, after all of this happened. And the Republican line at the time is, Obama's a pussy for not doing anything. Yeah. So like you can see how much the foreign policy has shifted with the partisan side,
yeah,
of this.
For sure.
Because now it's the right that's like, not happy about everything that's going on for the most part, like the America First right. Well, the left is kind of,
yeah, totally.
No, Lindsey Graham's pumped.
So just to rewind really quick, the civil war in Syria, when did that start?
So that starts in 2011 to 2013. It kind of picks up from a protest movement into a full-blown color revolution style.
Okay, so
with
it's
Timber Sycamore in 2013.
So it's parallel to the Arab Spring. So all, yes, this kind of unrest is sweeping through, mm-hmm, the entire Middle East at this time. Mm-hmm. And who is it between?
This is between a coalition of various rebel factions. When we described it before, like last summer when we covered a little bit, I said it's a seven-sided civil war.
Oh, that's right. Yep.
Right? That's a level of resolution of it. Another one you can say is you have Turkey, US/Western, and Kurds. Those are kind of like the broad three categories you could boil it down to versus the forces of Assad.
Gotcha.
And Assad backed by Russia and Iran.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. And then there's that meme headline that is a real headline that says like something about, you know, forces backed by the CIA are battling forces backed by the military.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
And who's winning?
We have that. The LA Times link.
Yeah.
You want to see that? It is. You have to see it. In Syria, militias armed by the Pentagon fight those armed by the CIA. This is 2016.
Yeah, I remember when that article came out because I quote that all the time.
Yeah.
That's sick.
That's wild. Okay, so these are two of the different factions in the seven-sided war, the civil war that's going on?
Yeah, 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 right. And so what isn't clear, though, is exactly, and there's a lot of evolution over this time frame. This is a long time frame, right? And there's kind of like a drawdown period, ceasefire is probably too strong of a word, of about 7 to 8 years that kind of leads into this current moment where Assad looked like he was back into the good graces of the international community. He rejoined the Arab League. He was kind of around doing diplomatic stuff. And, you know, by 2020, Russia starts to draw down their support because they have to focus on Ukraine. Iran starts to increase their support. you know, if you talk to kind of like why this moment happened, is it's claimed by the main leader. I always forget this guy's name. I can't pronounce it. I gotta read it.
Al-Jabari?
Abu Muhammad al-Jalani.
Not Jabari.
Yeah. Jalani.
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 Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Al-Baghdadi.
We'll get it right.
In this time frame, you know, he says that the rebels kind of became a coherent fighting force. Like beforehand, it was all chaotic. They're fighting each other like this. And by, you know, from 2016, 2017 to 2024, it is now kind of developed into an actual fighting force that can govern and do everything it wants to do.
So a lot of those seven factions that were previously embattled are and have now coalesced, and then that's the force that ended up sieging Damascus.
In different places. So this map kind of shows it. If you see the top left part of Syria, that I can't tell you the colors, but it's kind of like, was that a green?
Yeah, the top left is the Syrian Free Army.
Good job,
yeah.
Dave.
Yeah, so you have that, which is kind of Turkish-backed, Western-backed. You have Kurds, which are to the east. That's kind of the yellow.
In northeast.
And yeah. Then the blue in the bottom, and that is that's just pure Western American forces.
Well, and it's probably important to remember, too, because like most people just have a passing knowledge of these random names that get thrown out in the news all the time because they don't really dig deep into this. Is like, you know, the Kurds are our biggest ally in the Middle East all the time, right? They're always just thrown out there of like, well, we have to protect the Kurds because anything that ever happens, we have to protect the Kurds. And then like 5 days later, it'll be like, who's the Kurds, right? And we just kind of like forget about them again.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, well, I guess Republicans blocked that or whatever. It's like, and nobody cares anymore. Yeah. Kurds are lost.
And we need to return to this because in the end, my prediction, well, at least one of my predictions here is the Kurds are going to get screwed in this whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the
they get screwed in every single deal ever.
Well, always. Yeah. So in this time frame, a new group is formed out of the ISIS, former ISIS, former Al-Qaeda groups.
In the time frame of the drawdown?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's Hayat Tahrir al-Shaim. And that is, or just HTS. So they're Al-Qaeda offshoot in Syria. They march on Aleppo last week. Aleppo.
What is Aleppo?
Then on to Hama, and now the southern forces have taken Damascus itself, which are probably Israeli-American-based forces.
Well, it's also important to note, too, is like these are all the factions that are at war, but they're all getting funding and whatnot from various in a larger proxy war that's going on, right? Mm-hmm. Because Syria, Bashar al-Assad, very much aligned with Putin and Russia, you know, we have kind of Israel and Turkey's interests at heart in this whole conflict as well. So all of those are kind of coming in. It's like important to remember in all of these smaller country civil wars, there's larger battles taking place, especially on the funding financier side.
Yeah. How is this impacting what's going on in Israel right now? What's Israel up to?
Well, Israel has used this as an excuse to defensively take more territory.
Oh.
It's a defensive...
Also wiped out the entire Syrian Navy.
Yeah, also did that. Two days after Assad left. So Assad leaves on the 8th, right? And so the Syrian Prime Minister, Muhammad Ghazi al-Jalal, announces that the Syrian government would hand over power to the newly elected, a new government headed by the rebels on the 8th. On the 9th, the rebels take Damascus, right? So Damascus isn't taken yet, but 2 days beforehand, he leaves. Today, Israel wipes out their navy with airstrikes.
Today being the 10th.
Yeah.
So the next day.
Yeah. Israel takes, and I don't know about wiped out. At least there are many strikes on existing Syrian navy. What remains, if you see the white area, that's where all of the, that's kind of where Assad had all of his forces still remaining. So this would be on the naval part of that, right? So this is still not completely conquered territory, although the government is currently gone, right? So what is the existing remaining Syrian forces going to do, government forces going to do?
Do we know where Assad is yet?
Yeah. No.
Like, is it confirmed?
I thought it was in Russia.
I've seen
Russia.
Seven different stories.
I've seen him shot down by the IDF. I've seen a whole bunch of stuff. Yeah. I haven't seen anything confirmed yet. So yeah. As of now.
Still unconfirmed.
So he fled some number of days ago, within the last week, obviously. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was that story that like his plane took a sharp turn and might have crashed into the mountains. We don't know about that. There was also some... assertion that he was given asylum in Russia and is hunkered down there, but I guess we'll find out.
Yeah. I've seen memes that Putin's allowing him to start a bakery. Like
I heard he was going to go back to ophthalmology.
Yeah, ophthalmology, yep, saw that as well.
So one thing that should be noted is that Israel's cast and Turkey are both casting this additional territory they've taken, Turkey in the north, Israel in the south by west, as temporary buffer zone. to establish basically control to make sure that forces that are currently mobilized in Syria don't just go on to attack these places. That's what they claim. Now, note, the Golan Heights themselves were taken in 1967 as a temporary buffer zone as well.
I was going to ask, what is the likelihood that that stays temporary?
Yeah. Well, and also, additionally to that, what's America's role? Trump was the one who recognized the Golan Heights as, you know, Israeli territory, right, as a way to make the Abrahamic Accords go, I guess, for Israel's side. And then additionally to that, today, Israel annexed the Golan Heights. So they annexed the Golan Heights, something that they weren't supposed to have all this time, and then they took more territory as a buffer zone and then made the Golan Heights and basically official Israeli territory.
Wow.
Yeah.
So the borders of the Middle East are being redrawn again. Mm-hmm. How does this impact Putin's war in Ukraine?
Well, so a lot of people I don't think it impacts the war in Ukraine other than as a bargaining chip. On the other side, you can think of this as similar to, okay, so deep water ports in the Mediterranean are really critical to Russia, and they've had them in Syria for a long time. So how to, in the ending of the war in Ukraine, they have the Kursk offensive areas, right? That's that offensive that happened this summer where they took a bunch of territory and kind of a offensively from Ukraine into Russia. So he's going to want that back, and he's going to want his deep water ports back. So how much of Ukraine will he give back to get those things is the question.
Russia,
so there's a bargaining chip for the West to play against Russia at that point.
So, okay. So I just want to dig in on this a little bit. So his deep water ports are in Syria.
For the Mediterranean.
Okay. So yeah.
Not for like the Black Sea. And
what's the significance of a deep water port for those that might not understand?
Well, it's where you can put your large Navy vessels and like your large shipping containers.
And this has different value than the warm water port on the Black Sea, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, no. those are naval vessel capable ports as well. Like you're thinking of like Crimea.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Crimea is another really important naval vessel, but it's for a different sea, right? Going from the Black Sea to the Mediterranean is not that easy, right?
Right, so you want
both.
Gotcha.
So you can project power.
I see. So he's basically, his naval capacity is kind of being cut in half by not having the Syrian component of that.
Yeah. And at least collaboration by a friendly regime there too, right? So you have to set up a deal for a new non-friendly regime for the access to that port. And now you just have that as a bargaining chip to use against Russia.
There's also just pipeline to Syria as well. Like there's just energy flow.
Yes.
From Russia to Syria.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, so that's always been a big thing underlying this whole conflict was that specific relationship on energy with Syria and Russia.
So this, I mean, like you're saying, just to reiterate, it could really be seen by people as a play by the West backing whomever they backed in this conflict, the rebels, to acquire territory that's very valuable to Putin in order to have something to bargain with when it comes time for the Ukraine-Russia conflict to be resolved.
That might explain the now, right? It might explain the now that Russia didn't just end support in 2020, but it started to draw down support, is the theory. So less Russian direct support, less Russian airstrikes in the area, less Russian munitions because it's been deployed to Ukraine, things like that, right? And then additionally, Iran is also stretched thin at the moment because they're currently deployed all their resources to Hezbollah and Lebanon. So there's a weaker moment, and that kind of explains how lightning quick this was, how much of a, they're calling it, you know, paper tiger that the Assad forces actually were. I think that's a little bit misunderstood. You could overplay that, but it's still a rational calculation. You know, I can see how people would get there.
And now we're going to have a nice little spot here this was a nice little blockade in between all of the American influence that exists here. This was just sitting there right in the middle. Now that's a perfect spot for a pipeline.
Right there. Well, I want to know too, like a really, the pipeline is a part of it could be part of it. And that's actually a proposed pipeline, but there's also what I call is the clean break motivation. So Clean Break was a 1996 document. It was written by Richard Perl for Benjamin Netanyahu when he was a prime minister. Basically what it said is Iran is funding Hezbollah, right, through Syria. So if you look at the map, Iran, Syria, right? So how do they get the weapons from Iran to Syria to then Lebanon so that they can then fund Hezbollah? Keep in mind, Israel really has two opponents, Hamas and Hezbollah. Right, Egypt's no longer a major opponent. Jordan's no longer a major opponent. Even Saudi Arabia and places like that because of the Abrahamic Accords. But at the time, they're still looking at these guys. Some of these guys, Saudi Arabia is not in that group, but a lot of these guys are opponents geopolitically for Israel. So what it recommended was removing those barriers by overthrowing those countries. So you overthrow the country of Iraq, Syria, Libya's in there as well for lots of reasons, and then lastly, Iran. So what's coming true is this. Now, I have a video. I don't know if you guys want to get into it. It's General Wesley Clark talking about the seven countries in 5 years. I think yes. It really explains the American expression of this theory of the clean break, a new strategy for securing the realm.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, No. He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda?" He said, No. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail." So I came back to see him a few weeks later. And by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today. And he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out seven countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran." I said, "Is it classified?" He said, "Yes, sir." I said, "Well, don't show it to me." And I saw him a year or so ago, and I said, "You remember that?" He said, "Sir, I didn't show you that memo. I didn't show it to you."
Yeah, so that Shiite, so this is the Sunni Shia division, right? Hamas, typically Sunni. Hezbollah, typically Shiite. Iran, Shiite. Syria, Sunni, right? So, but they're collaborating on the Palestinian issue. And Syria is kind of right on the merger of those two. You get some Sunnis in Turkey, but you get more Shiites and that sort of thing. So if you like, north is more Shiite, south is more Sunni, that's generally kind of true. So that you know, pipeline or like division as you cut the line through Syria, that's the goal, right? Removing that calculus of Iran's ability to support Hezbollah so that Israel can prosecute a war against the Palestinians without having to fight on two fronts.
I see. So this is just removing another potential enemy from Israel's border, basically.
Right. And we've been covering this as like, okay, so Israel's got this problem with Hezbollah in the north and their fight against in Gaza against Hamas. That whole problem itself is what Israel's nightmare has always been, right, where they have to fight all those. But what we're seeing is Israel's ability to conduct these operations in Syria in order to try to shut those off so that they can crunch down on the Palestinians even more over the long run.
So now that everything has concluded in here, what does the power vacuum look like?
Well, Biden has already promised your tax dollars for the new Syrian government. Already.
Cool.
We will support. Biden says
this many tax dollars. They're finding my tax dollars places I didn't even know they were.
Biden says U.S. will support Syria and its neighbors after Assad dynasty collapses, from NBC New York.
Yeah.
Yep.
That was fast.
And then let me guess. It's probably going to be USAID.
Mm-hmm. Which is a part of the whole of society framework that Mike Benz talks about in sort of this soft power wielding throughout the world.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, and because right now we have the most powerful rebel faction, Al-Qaeda. Remember those guys?
I do.
Remember those guys?
Funded
They're
going to
be
CIA.
Filling that right in there.
Before we gloss over it, the clip that we just played, General Wesley Clark talking about these seven countries. which, I mean, which are the only ones outstanding? We've got Iran.
Iran.
Is Lebanon conquered?
It's
run by Hezbollah, right?
Yeah, right. It's run by Hezbollah, but Israel's in the process of trying to reshape it.
Right.
Yeah.
So they're currently in conflict, but obviously we're in conflict with Iran as well. Are there still any that are like, I mean, what are the unfinished projects for the neocon agenda?
You know, I'm not familiar with the activities of Sudan. I know that there is covert operations in Sudan and stuff like that. And then, you know, obviously that's part of AFRICOM and all the efforts that we've done throughout the global war on terror, the GWAT, over that period of time. And then, yeah, the last one, the big one is, of course, Iran.
Yeah, and that's the biggest dog in this entire thing. So we've got everybody around them now.
Yeah, so they're probably not feeling terribly confident at the moment.
Yeah, and we'll see how it plays out in Lebanon. I mean, before, like I said, Israel went into Lebanon in the early 2000s, did not go well for Israel. I can't tell you whether or not they're able to accomplish their goal there. But that's, if you look at it from a strategic level, that's their strategic aim, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not even sure that the strategic aim in this case was to overthrow Assad. I think it was just to bring him to the table. But rather than going to the table of the United States, where he would commit to shutting off fellow Shiite support to Hezbollah through Iran, he instead said, I'm going to go with Russia and Iran instead. And that's what kind of was the nail in the coffin that resulted in this overthrow.
Wow. So the new presumed head of Syria, remind me his name?
Abu Mohammed al-Jilani.
Al-Jilani.
Jilani, yes. Yes.
Okay. He is al-Qaeda?
He's HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Shaim.
Which is a sub-affiliate.
Well, it makes it clear when you get into his biography. All right. So this guy, born in Saudi Arabia, as an exile family, originally from the Golan Heights.
Oh.
Right? So they're kicked out of the Golan Heights when the U.S. takes over in 1967. His family's kind of in in Saudi Arabia. He goes back to Syria. He's radicalized by the Second Intifada. He then goes to fight in Iraq for basically the militias there.
Iraq 2,
okay. Yeah. He's in Fallujah.
The sequel.
When the Battle for Fallujah is happening. So this is one of the most intense fighting battles, campaigns in Iraq War II. He wound up in one of our super prisons there. Like, we built these massive prisons. He meets some of the people who would eventually go on to create ISIS. He joins ISIS under al-Baghdadi, who died like a dog.
Abu.
Yep. Al-Baghdadi. Died like a dog.
Yeah, right. He's the world head chopper champ. Right? This is the guy who establishes ISIS. ISIS, keep and remember, is a country kind of made out of the area between the very rural area in western Iraq and eastern Syria.
Wait, ISIS is?
ISIS is, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like a pseudo country?
Yeah, it was at one point. Yeah.
Okay. Islamic State of
it's the Islamic State.
The Islamic State of and the Levant, ISIL. What's the second eye?
I can't remember what
that's why region. Am I spacing on
we
it?
We don't
right
need
now
to get bogged yeah down.
But
it's meant to mean the entire region.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Right. There's this, if you really want to get a good visualization of this, it's a great Vice video, when Vice was good. And it shows this guy, and he gets in a Jeep and he drives over to the line between Syria and Iraq, and he gets out and he's like, ISIS, that sort of thing, and kind of saying, fuck you, Sykes-Picot.
Okay.
That's the kind of memory we got going on here.
Since you invoked Sykes-Picot.
Oh, it's supposed to be Iraq and the Levant.
Yeah, so, Iraq and yeah Levant.
Oh, okay. So that's Levant ISIL.
Levant is the word that they use to describe Syria, Lebanon, and Israel.
Yeah, this whole region right here on the map, right, and then Iraq next to it. Yeah.
Okay. And since you invoked it, and this is one Middle East foreign policy fact I do know, Sykes-Picot is the agreement that drew the political borders for all the countries in the Middle East.
Kind of, yes. Okay. It's like
one of three.
Think of it more like it's the discussion about it that was leaked as a cable memo that then blew up around the world as a, you know, this is, and keep in mind, the motive there was to break up the Ottoman Empire so it could never be a power center to challenge the West again. That's a really important fact.
Yeah.
Right? So imagine if you grew up knowing that where you live, the lines were all drawn, the dictators installed, all the resources themselves were plotted and designed and divvied up between countries, specifically to facilitate a foreign government's and a foreign people's maintenance of your lack of power and ability to be your own culture and society and all that kind of stuff.
Right, which is why we have Sunni and Shia and Kurds and all these different like cultural peoples living inside the same political borders and constantly at war with each other, right?
And separated by political borders, very importantly, too. Like, the Kurds are in the worst position out of all the groups, right? They're sitting right between Turkey, Syria, and Iraq.
Yeah, and, then you have the Pashtuns.
When you look at the three dots there, that's Kurdistan.
Yeah, this is where like this is where a theoretical Kurdistan would be, yeah, right in here.
Drawn on ethnic lines.
And it's the same thing in that you have the Pashtuns over in between Afghanistan and Pakistan. Mm-hmm. Like, that should technically probably be, for the sake of peace, probably be some sort of a Pashtunistan.
Yeah.
Right.
It has a nice ring to it.
Yeah. But these are specifically drawn to keep them powerless and minimize their ability to do that. And then secondarily, Kuwait exists where it does next to Iraq, for example, classic, so that you can't have someone who controls distribution in a water port and lots of those oil fields simultaneously.
Wild. Yeah. So back to Al Jilani.
So he goes, he joins ISIS in Iraq. He's then assigned by al-Baghdadi, lead head chopper.
Is dead.
Died like a dog. he was sent, because of his background in Syria, his knowledge of Syria, to expand the Islamic State into Syria in 2011, calling it al-Nusra. So that's what Seymour Hersh was talking about, is al-Nusra's activities at that time.
Yeah, that's first chemical weapon attack.
So at this point, the lead front of al-Qaeda, and this is according to the State Department at the time, is an al-Qaeda front. Now, I think Seymour is saying that, and I think that's
point. Can you reiterate that one more time?
So the State Department at the time said al-Nusra is a branch of al-Qaeda. Now, remembering who al-Qaeda was. Al-Qaeda was the Afghanistan Mujahideen International Fighting Unit that was formed after the Mujahideen had kicked out the USSR out of Afghanistan. They then formed into al-Qaeda under Osama bin Laden in response to American bombing campaigns in Iraq, right, throughout the 1990s. So he then picks up the international jihad. They have a vision of an international caliphate where all the countries in the world are Muslim states as like an end goal. So we're told for all this time that the end goal of the evilness of al-Qaeda is that they don't want freedom anywhere in the world. They want an Islamic State everywhere. Going to put all the women in burqas, that sort of thing, right? And then what we said is, let's give those guys weapons because they're on our side in Syria. In fact, we have a diplomatic cable from our people saying, actually, al-Qaeda is on our side in Syria, and that's why we're giving them weapons.
Mm-hmm. That's insane.
Yeah.
That's just insane.
So it later splintered, al-Nusra splinters into three groups. One of them being HTS, where our boy Al Jilani goes. He founds HTS as like a leader in that one. He fights the other al-Qaeda units, probably on behalf of the CIA. Don't know, though, for sure.
Because the CIA has to not let al-Qaeda get too powerful.
Yeah,
right?
and also
got to contain.
Yeah, this is also the Trump era, because Trump comes in, he says, why are we giving money to and resources to al-Qaeda? And so they split the group, they fund the moderates, which HTS is supposed to be a moderate-ish faction. And then, even though he's still on the terrorist watch list, he's got $10 million bounty on his head right now. And he did throughout the Trump regime. But So anyways, he's still on our side because we're against Assad.
Hold on. Guys, I have a great idea to fund this podcast. You want to go to the Middle East?
Radical.
Okay, I'm
sorry. Well, it's also just because, remember, there's also things like with Hamas and Israel, where Benjamin Netanyahu said we have to control the height of the flame, right? Like, that's a common tactic with all of these groups.
Mm-hmm. It's also a good way to bring Assad to the table, right? Mm-hmm. Assad watched the dictator of Libya get ousted by the Arab Spring, and probably had the fuel set on the fire by the State Department, USAID, and the CIA, and all that kind of stuff, right?
Hillary Clinton,
and then he got brought out of his palace and sodomized to death.
With curvy swords. Like,
I don't want to do that. Right?
Gaddafi
so
did, yeah.
That's that fear factor. It's the crazy guy in the room. You want the crazy guy with you, so it intimidates your opponent, so then you can exercise power over them. So there's like that realpolitik side of that. I think that is real. And we made a deal with the devil. And this guy then went on to basically lead HTS, which is made the biggest initial gains in capturing the North in the last 2 weeks. And now he's kind of been put up as, and he was interviewed by CNN of all places. Al Jilani was. And we have an interview. So this is his motive in the interview with CNN.
People who fear Islamic governance either have seen incorrect implementations of it or do not understand it properly. We are talking about something that aligns with the traditions and nature of the region. The most important thing is to build institutions. We are not talking about rule by individuals or personal whims. It's about institutional governance. Syria deserves a governing system that is institutional, not one where a single ruler makes arbitrary decisions.
What is the ruler he's talking about there is Assad, right? He's saying that we want institutions, Islamic institutions, so you shouldn't be afraid of that because you're not understanding it appropriately. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's his goal, an Islamic state in Syria.
I'm sorry, I got distracted a little bit by how brand new his shirt is. Do you see the crease in the collar?
The CIA just issued it. They just did it. Right? And you notice how much it looks like Zelensky's?
That's what Kyle was saying.
Right. There's some memes on there about that.
It's literally just Zelensky with a beard. Like, he kind of has the same facial structure.
Yeah, he does, doesn't he?
It just looks like you put a beard on and they even have like the same shirt.
As Trump would say, straight out of Central Casting.
So, and now the interviewer gives him a question about diversity and protecting minorities, right? Because obviously this is a fear that we kind of queued up a little bit. You had Assad in Syria, traditionally is a very diverse country, and how they dealt with Christians and other minorities within the country, very important to their heritage and culture. How is this former Al-Qaeda operative going to act, given that he is now seems to be the focal point for the new regime now taking power?
HTS rule would mean, including minorities.
No one has the right to erase another group. These sects have coexisted in this region for hundreds of years, and no one has the right to eliminate them. There must be a legal framework that protects and ensures the rights of all, not a system that serves only one sect, as Assad's regime has done.
You know, listening to you speaking, you've gone through quite the transformation. Once an Al-Qaeda leader, your group has had affiliations with Al-Qaeda, with ISIS, and now you are projecting this image of a moderate leader and a moderate group. What is HTS right now?
Hayat Tahrir al-Sham is one of the factions in the region, just like all the others. Now we're talking about a larger project. We're talking about building Syria. Hayat Tahrir al-Sham is merely one detail of this dialogue, and it may dissolve at any time. It's not an end in itself, but a means to perform a task confronting this regime. Once that task is complete, it will transition to a state of governance, institutions, and so on. I believe that everyone in life goes through phases and experiences, and these experiences naturally increase a person's awareness. A person in their 20s will have a different personality than someone in their 30s or 40s, and certainly someone in their 50s.
So are those days behind you?
Sometimes it's essential to adjust to reality, and because someone who rigidly clings to certain ideas and principles without flexibility cannot effectively lead societies or navigate complex conflicts like the one happening in Syria.
People listening to this,
call it there.
Yeah, yeah.
He's grown up.
Yeah, I mean, he had kind of like an edgy phase, but now he's totally cool.
Yeah,
yeah.
He's ready to lead a country.
He's practically a neoliberal already.
And all of Al-Qaeda has grown up.
Quick question.
Everyone has an emo phase, you know?
Everybody just has that phase, like, ooh, let's overthrow a government.
let's chop off the heads of all of our opponents. That phase, easy phase, you know?
I'm not an insurgent.
I watched those videos. I remember those videos. I saw some crazy ISIS videos of head chopping.
Yeah.
When was this interview conducted?
Yesterday.
Wow. So CNN brought in this guy, or went to him, whatever, literally in the midst of this overthrow.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're both funded by CIA, so it's probably easy to make the network happen.
I mean, I'm just kind of shocked by like how obvious that is, like mm-hmm. that there's so much support on this side by the legacy media. That seems pretty telling to me.
It was, I mean, if you look at the kind of people who audit the larger trend of the moment and are critics of that larger trend, which sometimes I miss because I get too much into the details, there definitely seems to be, and a lot of people are saying this, including like Glenn Greenwald and others, who are pointing to this and saying, there appears to be a media psyop going on here trying to brand this dude as if he's not the second in command, lead head chopper of Al-Qaeda in Syria and Iraq, like 2 minutes ago.
Like grew up. Right?
Right.
Like that we shouldn't be talking about people's pasts. We should be talking about people's futures.
Yeah.
You're full of shit today.
Yeah, exactly. And anti-war did a write-up of this, of how they're not terrorists anymore. This guy's not a terrorist anymore because we like him. And that's basically what a terrorist is. It's just like the people we don't like are terrorists. The people we do like, freedom fighters.
Freedom fighters.
Yeah, exactly. One man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter.
So this is a U.S. consider removing HTS from terror list after Syria takeover. U.S. officials say they're in contact with the Al-Qaeda linked group.
Good job, guys. You did it.
I was literally just going to say that.
Yo, you did such a great job.
Wow. Yep. This has all happened so fast.
Yeah, it was so quick.
But
well, the Civil War has been going on for 15 years.
Well, true, but with like a very quiet, like a dormant period. And I guess part of my question is like, how much of this has just been happening under the surface and being planned for, and the moment just presented itself for this to take place, and it was executed on
the
on time.
The timing is interesting, just kind of considering new leadership coming in and things like that.
I'm going to come. So
and that's important, right? So the current state director, the current State Department reacting, Jake Sullivan, who's the national security advisor, this guy is like, it's him and Blinken, probably actually who are president, foreign policy-wise, right? He says, quote, we aren't crying about it. He said that at the National Reagan Defense Forum in California 2 days ago. So when that happened, he said, we aren't crying about it. Now, no, it was Jake Sullivan is the guy whose Hillary Clinton's email was leaked, admitting that Al-Qaeda is on our side in Syria.
Wow.
Right. So that's the State Department saying it's Al-Qaeda. It's not like it was. So that kind of, when Seymour said it's just they call everybody Al-Qaeda just so that they can use the 2001 AUMF, which is the law he was referring to. Kinda, yeah. But their own cables internally are using that phraseology, I think, probably for a reason.
Mm.
Right.
So to your question or to your point, Kyle, about the timing of all this, with Trump coming in, how much of this is happening now because things have to happen now because there's an expectation that Trump will have a much less interventionist foreign policy?
Well, you kind of have Tulsi, who's a Assad toady.
Adina, yeah. Yeah, so Thomas Massie had a tweet about that, and that's his theory. And I think that's a good theory there. His whole case was... you know, from the beginning, this was always like a Hillary Clinton project that was largely not that Trump was never that thrilled about. He wanted Assad out of Syria for a lot of reasons. He did try to assassinate Assad, but he also wanted Assad out of Syria.
Did he try to assassinate Assad?
According to Scott Horton, he floated the idea, talked about it. It just never happened.
Yeah, because my recollection of the only real major thing that Trump did in Syria was... well, Assad gassed his own people again right before the Civil War was about to be finished. Strange. And then Trump bombed an airstrip. And then it was like 3 months into Trump's presidency. And then CNN's like, he's finally a president.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's the only real recollection
he's
I have.
Up.
Of,
yeah. He's grown up. He's grown up.
So you could see that in an administration, there's a push-pull happening. His advisor is saying, we need to do this. It's really important. Israel's asking him to, right?
Yeah.
Right? And it's not, I mean... If I can self-criticize, self-reflect a little bit on the election cycle, at least one of the things that I've thought about, I think what I did is I kind of put Israel as like a concern aside a little bit because like Biden is just as bad, Kamala is just as bad as Israel as Trump is in many ways. I don't really see a difference between the two. So it didn't really form in the calculus of how to talk about the election dynamic because of the same on that issue, right? But, I mean, Trump's history here is as if he was a member of the Likud party, right, when it comes to relationships with Israel. So if Israel's asking for taking out Assad because of things like the clean break theory, right, and what they need in order to eventually get peace in Israel by taking out Palestine altogether, well, I mean, he would, right? But he would want to do that as efficiently and quickly as possible. So it's like, let's just bomb Assad. That makes sense to me. And just take out that individual.
Pretty sure Horton... in his interview with Liam, called him like a Mossad asset or something.
Called Trump a Mossad asset?
Yeah, I don't know if it was Mossad, but it was... like,
probably Likud.
It was essentially saying what David's saying, yeah.
Well, and I mean, you can certainly see the continuation of that trend with Miriam Adelson giving $100 million and obviously getting a lot of pro-Israel people appointed to the cabinet, at least, you know, nominated to the cabinet not confirmed yet, of course.
Right. I mean, like, you can get really blackpilled on that, but I mean, at the end of the day, your choice is between those two and Chase Oliver, who had the only good foreign policy on Israel. Right.
Yeah.
And, like, what are you gonna do?
Okay. I'm gonna crack open the rabbit hole here for a second. Have you guys seen anything about this Greater Israel thing?
Yeah.
What's the deal with that?
Well, at a UN meeting, Netanyahu, I can never say that guy's name right, Bibi,
you did
Bibi,
great.
You can say Netanyahu.
Basically holds up a thing, a map of Israel that includes, doesn't include any Palestinian territories, and includes Lebanon and Syria being in part of the state of Israel.
So like, well, cool, if we can't get Palestine, we'll just take all this other stuff.
No, Palestine's not on the map.
Oh,
that was the real controversy of it.
It covers everything.
Them controlling part of Syria and Lebanon was like, that's just him being who he is. But completely eliminating Gaza and the West Bank
seems like he's already doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
Can we get a bigger map of this this whole concept? Because this is, I mean, I've seen it like covering a ton of territory.
Yeah,
it's huge.
Yeah. Oh, that's Israel in 1948.
Yeah, that's not the right one. That was just the first thing that came up. I was still looking.
But
here, I think I got it.
Oh, okay.
Keep talking.
Oh, okay. Important here, like, he's a political actor advocating for his point of view, right? So you go back and he's saying to the Congress, hey, it would be great if we overthrew Iraq, right? So that's him just pursuing the new Middle East. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Wait. That's not even what I've seen before either. That's different.
This is at the United Nations General Assembly in 2023, is this image. So this is the one that David was referring to. I've seen a lot of like meme images, and I don't know how accurate those are on it.
Oh, actually, that's not too terribly different. That's a lot bigger, actually, than what the one I've seen, which I've got here. I'll share it with you, Kyle. But so there is the idea out there that Israel should be bigger or is going to be bigger. Then
I actually don't know the context of when he introduced that map in the speech he was giving at the time, so I don't have that off the top of my head.
All right, so I don't know anything about who posted this, but this is the map that I've been seeing like circulating around X, which obviously implicates almost the entirety of Syria, over half of Syria, half of Iraq, half of Saudi Arabia, a portion of Egypt. I mean, I don't know. This could just be a conspiracy theory. I've just been seeing it around, so I was just curious if anybody else had and if there was any like substance to it, or if this is totally, you know, just some fear-mongering stuff or conspiracy babble.
You're full of shit today.
Maybe.
My understanding is it maps to the original Zionist project.
Which is the map, because what
this poster is referring to is Theodor Herzl, who's like the OG guy of Israeli independence and like kind of like the spiritual father of the Jewish state. Right. Like going back to the 1800s, like the original, it's a movement that gained traction in Europe for over several decades. And then eventually came to fruition in the 1940s. Right.
So this is the Israel of Theodor Herzl from 1904 to Rabbi Fishman from 1947. Right. And this, what it expresses is that the promise of Israel was supposed to be from the Euphrates River, which is where your northern border there that runs right through Iraq, to the Red Sea.
From the river to the sea, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Different river.
Including
different
parts of
sea.
Oh, sorry. River of Egypt. So that makes sense. So that's why it's cutting through Middle Egypt there.
The Nile.
That would be the Nile.
And then to the Euphrates. So it's saying this is the area that is quote. Now, what it's saying here is a statement of ideology, right?
Right.
Not a statement of strategic plan. Greater Israel, what I was referring to, was an actual map that just miscluded the Palestinian territories and then included areas that they believe they had claim to in Syria and in Lebanon.
Interesting.
Yeah. But so what I guess is more plan ambition versus this being more philosophical.
Sure.
Which is okay.
Yeah. Of course. It seems more substantial because of this second link that I shared here. Kyle, it appears on a patch, at least in one instance, on an IDF soldier. This shape shows up, which is interesting. And I can't read Hebrew, so I don't know what that says. But seems to be that the ideology is out there amongst the people involved.
I mean, I would be wary about Okay, so in terms of influence, would Israel like to have that range of influence? Yeah.
Oh, I imagine they would.
Yeah, I mean, for the same reason that Russia doesn't want NATO right on its borders. Right, and we wouldn't want Mexico being controlled by a hostile state.
They just want to be right next to Iran.
They want to have as much buffer between, you know, Israel, and, you know, their opponents. That's why they're taking this land, which is, compared to that, not that much land. but I mean, compared to its gains in 1967, things like that, is on par with some of those, right? Yeah. It's like about a little bit smaller than the Golan Heights again, all over again. So that's
just
my understanding.
Just a couple of apartment complexes.
Just a couple of apartment complexes. You know, the funny thing is like the whole thing, because like if we're going back to the original Zionist movement and the Zionist organization, because that's what it was called, the Zionist organization, that it was all about the promotion of immigration to Palestine from Europe. And because he's like out of Hungary, or I think he's like, yeah, he's from like Budapest or something. And he's promoting all of these like European Jews to immigrate to Palestine and just start taking over buildings and whatnot. Like that is the plan. And then we're looking at what's happening here in America. I'm just like, it's just a couple apartment buildings.
You know, like, what's
it's
the
just kind of it's kind of funny that like they do equate to each other quite well.
It's there, but I've also noted it would be as if the cartel was actually buying the apartment buildings. No, to be fair to the Zionists, I mean, most of the purchases throughout the Ottoman Empire era was financed by Western money. Rothschild's
being one of the major ones, right?
Yeah, but also just Western finance. There was lots of wealthy Jews across Europe that
like it's pretty impressive, actually. Like you just get all this venture capital funding for your movement over the course of decades, you know, and then eventually just like
start
doing
a country.
This. Yeah, and then you come in and you just kind of migrate and assimilate and then take over a country and then have a war. To kind of finish out the job.
Well, right? I mean, you have to grow up at some point.
You have to grow up. but like that is the history of the project, right? Is like there's outside funding, you know. But like most startups always have outside funding. America had outside funding in the revolution, right? And
Libertopia, Vit Jedlik's country,
yeah.
Privately purchased, kind of a crypto haven in like Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. Pretty cool. Mm-hmm. We chatted with him at Freedom Fest.
Yeah.
Really, really cool thing.
So, yeah, I mean, I think
wars yet, though.
And that's always been the criticism, right? It's always been that, you know, Israel as founding of a country done so by voluntary means of purchasing land and then bringing people there is a very different project than what happened in the Nakba, right? The Nakba was hundreds of thousands of people displaced, tens of thousands of people killed in a civil war after, you know, the British pulled out.
Not every startup goes well.
So like that's always been the
sometimes there's a genocide.
I don't know if that tracks, Kyle. I'm sorry.
So interesting here is you might ask the question, what is America's interest here in overthrowing the Assad regime, right? So I articulated the clean break memo. That is an Israeli memo, right? It's written for Benjamin Netanyahu, right? But we point to it as like this is an interesting phenomena that kind of parallels a lot of strategy that Israel has influence on America in pursuing since the war on terror era, right? But you got people like Michael Knowles, right, at the Daily Wire tweeting, can someone explain to me why we're supposed to celebrate Bashar al-Assad's replacement by a member of al-Qaeda? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting moment right there.
Yeah.
Because Michael Knowles, not exactly known for his criticism of U.S. foreign policy.
No, and interestingly, Dave Smith tweeted at him saying, or retweeted him saying, the answer to that question would get you fired from the Daily Wire. Which I don't know if that's true or not, but you wouldn't expect
no,
that.
No, that's pretty true. I think that's pretty true.
You just wouldn't expect that.
We can take a look at it.
Daily Wire.
I mean, Ben Shapiro did a video responding to it. It's a 3-minute long video on the Shia Crescent thesis, which is straight out of, like, when you hear this, listen to what we did up front with the 1996 document. Of the clean break.
Okay, there were significant human rights predations against Christians on the ground, not only in the areas controlled by Sunni terrorists, but also in the areas that were controlled by Shia terrorists. Syria is about 10% Christian. Okay, so is it about to get worse? It definitely could, which would, of course, be a terrible thing. And then you have the question of what Bashar al-Assad was doing to the country, which is killing hundreds of thousands of people using everything up to and including chemical weapons. Well, he's gone now, and Israel has been striking a lot of the chemical weapons depots to prevent them from falling into the hands of the new rebel alliance over here. Okay, so
Star Wars?
Again, is any of this wonderful? Particularly, it isn't. But the one thing that is an upside is that the Iranian crescent is dead. Okay, the Shia crescent that, again, stretched all the way from Iran all the way across to Lebanon, that is now dead. What does that mean? It means that the Iranian regime is actually in quite real trouble here. All of their biggest proxies are gone. Hamas, gone. Hezbollah, gone. Assad, gone. That means the Shia influence game is beginning to wane. It's beginning to end. The Houthis are basically isolated down there in Yemen. The Shia regime in Iran still has impact in Iraq, but internally, they are much, much, much weaker right now. So the border countries, what are they doing? Turkey is doing incursions into northern Syria. They were probably behind much of what's going on right now. They're attempting to grab territory in northern Syria. They're creating their own buffer zone. They're attempting to encroach on Kurdish territory, again, in the northeast of the country. Meanwhile, Israel in the south has the Golan Heights. And anybody, by the way, who thought that it was a good idea for Israel to give up the Golan Heights, yeah, you're an idiot. Okay, it's a good thing Israel has the Golan Heights. Otherwise, you'd have Sunni terrorists sitting up top over the Lake Tiberias and firing down into the valley in Israel. Okay, so Israel controls that area.
Stop it there.
Yep.
For Bennett's sake.
Yeah. Before Bennett loses his
mind.
Just
not a fan of his voice, yeah. or what's your... What's
everything your about him.
Just the whole thing.
Just makes me want to punch your baby.
he fired baby. Bennett's girl.
Support that. So notice that there, he doesn't actually articulate why it's good for America at all, right? But he does use the Shia crescent, right? Shia crescent. That is clean break. That is the word, that idea of that movement, that strategic goal was articulated in 1996 and now is being brought up and justified by the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Ben Shapiro.
It's not his job to articulate what's good for America.
Yeah, I suppose not. Well, who is? Is anybody articulating?
Don't be suspicious. Don't be suspicious.
Well, yeah, so so the question of it is like, is it good for anything? I mean, Trump has his opinion on it, right? I mean, he came out with the Truth Social, basically saying this isn't our fight, right? In short, it's kind of a long and
yeah, long which is first. You know, which is kind of nice to hear from the president-elect that it's not our fight. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he's just reiterating the things that Assad's gone, he fled the country. He's talking about the Russia dynamic. And then you also have J.D. Vance here defending Trump's position. As President Trump said, this is not our fight and we should stay out of it. Aside from that, opinions like this, like the one below, make me nervous. The last time this guy was celebrating events in Syria, we saw the mass slaughter of Christians in a refugee crisis that destabilized Europe. And he's referring to Josh Rogan, who is celebrating Syria is free, the rebels won, the people liberated, and goes on to kind of talking about the historic moment.
So we do have, we don't, so.
And J.D. Vance also, just down below, he's also recognizing the important facts here is many of the rebels are a literal offshoot of ISIS. One can hope they've moderated, but time will tell.
And that is the question,
one can hope
right?
They've grown up.
The question of the CNN interview, grown. Right? Is have they changed? Are they the moderate rebels that we hoped they were? And then in that, so we don't know what's going to happen to the minorities and the Christians. But we do know this is probably a good thing for Israel. And we actually have the man himself, Al Jalani, himself saying this in this video.
It's going towards stability. People are exhausted from war. So the country isn't ready for another one, and it's not going to get into another one. The source of our fears was from the Iranian militias, Hezbollah, and the regime, which committed the mass atrocities.
Yeah. And notice the people who he says, the bad guys, is the exact people that Israel wants to be the bad guys for the new regime.
Just interesting to see Israel and Al-Qaeda on the same side.
Yeah, that's really puzzling me right now. Has
it's
he just,
so puzzling.
Has he just flipped sides? Is that what we're seeing here? Is he sort of like flip sides, or are their interests really aligned?
Well, he gets this nifty little country here.
That's a pretty good incentive, I suppose.
It has a nice little backing behind it.
Yeah, yeah. Like,
yeah, I mean,
until it's time for him not to be the leader of that country anymore.
Well, there's always the chance of a future Gaddafi-ing happening. You know,
or a Saddam.
Depending if he gets a little too big for his britches or something. You know, like there's always that. Because that is the important thing, is a lot of these guys were our friends until they weren't.
Yeah.
And it's important to note that Al Jalani is a Sunni, right? So he has no natural affinity for the Shia, mm-hmm. right? So he's more likely to go along with Saudi Arabia and Jordan and the other countries that are currently in the Abrahamic Accords alongside and kind of basically dropping the Palestinian issue, even as, you know, the major motivating issue that mobilized Al-Qaeda was, you know, what happened to Shia people in Iraq.
Well, and he's probably become more pragmatic with age. He's no longer the man of his 20s that was really promoting for that big Sunni super state. Well, like, he can work with Israel now.
And how much is this just like the Azov Battalion? Right. So yeah. The Azov Battalion were terrible Nazis and they had SS patches, and it was just like, well, this is kind of a problem, but they're kind of heroes, right? For democracy, these Nazis in Ukraine.
Freedom fighters.
Same sort of thing here, right? Where we're kind of rebranding it, we're kind of resetting it up as a new thing so that we can now support it. And once you can support it rhetorically, then you can go in behind with USAID and build the institution so that you make sure it serves the hegemonic needs. So that's what America gets out of it, to square the circle. What America gets out of this, in theory, is greater hegemony and ability to project, isolate Iran as someone who doesn't take our lead, right? That's the goal. So from the CIA's point of view, from the deep state's point of view, from that ultimate ends point of view, it's what maintains U.S. hegemony and ability to project power across the Middle East for resources. And of course, the safety of Israel, which is a major ambition for all of these actors. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Well, I sure hope that it ends well.
Just like I hope everybody's having
plans,
fun.
Like, yeah. All of the neocon plans to overthrow a secular dictator and put in Al-Qaeda, I'm sure it's going to work great.
I just hope they're all having fun.
Yeah. It's really about the friends you make along the way.
That's right. That's right. A really warm and positive note to end this episode on.
It's a little play fighting, a little rambunctious nature.
If you said in 2001, by 2024, Al-Qaeda, we're going to be funding Al-Qaeda to the point where they're going to take over a country and we're going to be like, these are freedom fighters and really happy about it. Think about that. They could not imagine. Al-Qaeda was in Afghanistan, but they didn't control Afghanistan. The Taliban did. That's a different group, mm-hmm. right? We got kind of confused during that whole war about who was the bad guy, but Al-Qaeda was the guys who attacked us on 9/11.
But also the current people in Afghanistan are just an offshoot of the, like, it's just a Taliban sect.
Yeah, right. Right. So it's like the Taliban's not gone.
And we give them
billions. And we just funded like a long war to overthrow Assad, a secular dictator. For what reason? I mean, and this shows how far the American people are from the national security establishment. That architecture does not give a fuck about what happened on 9/11, something that should still outrage us. The greatest attack with the most amount of casualties ever on United States soil. And now we're going to put one of their people in charge of Syria as a Zelensky 2.0. Holy shit. What a moment.
Yeah,
you're full of shit today.
Man, I thought we were ending on warms and fuzzies.
Sorry, but I just had to make that point because I was thinking about all day. I was like, I just talking to freshman year me and just be like, that's what's going to happen in 2024. I'm like, yeah, no way. Not possible.
Future
man.
David radicalizes.
And the whole political realignment in our country has everybody on flip sides of where they were back then, too, which is also fascinating.
It's bizarre. Right? It's bizarre.
Because like I remember in 2014, 2015 era of like when the red line happened with Obama, I just remember. Member conservatives being that like libertarian talking to conservatives and them just being like Obama's too pussy to do it, and he's just like, and then they're just like, get Assad. Now all those same people are just like, oh man, we probably shouldn't have done that to Assad. Like, it's like, what happened?
Yeah,
it's like this, and like I mean literally the same people.
Yeah,
it's funny.
So anyways,
well, I'm sure we're gonna have plenty more updates on this story to bring to you as they continue to develop, because this much of it has happened inside of a week. So I'm sure, I mean, God knows what's going to happen in the next week.
Yep.
In that case, it's time to wrap up. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please do like, follow, subscribe anywhere you follow this podcast. For David Rand, Kyle Mack, Bennett, I'm Joe Sheehan. This is Human Reaction. We'll see you in the next one. Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com. And remember,
diversity is our strength. Al-Qaeda.